Support for today's broadcast comes from the Seaboat, with a southern style of cooking catfish, chicken, and shrimp, featuring the Seaboat sandwich, two pieces of fish on a wheat bun with lettuce, tomato, and tartar sauce, and desserts like sweet potato pie. The Seaboat at Bradley and Market in Champaign. Delivery and catering services at 351-6209. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Granard Center for the Performing Arts, a home for contemporary theatrical events in March and April. City Company teams up with musical ensemble Rachel's in Systems Layers. British and American companies Modi Rodi and the Builders Association present Aladdin. And the U of I Department of Theater offers Marisol and Aloha Say the Pretty Girls. For more information or tickets, visit GranardCenter.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, the story of a moment in America's struggle for civil rights will go back in time to 1925. An African-American doctor moved his family into a white neighborhood in Detroit. A mob gathered outside their home, bent on driving the family out. Historian Kevin Boyle is our guest. He is the author of Arc of Justice, A Saga of Race, Civil Rights, and Murder in the Jazz Age, a winner of the National Book Award. The book tells the story of Dr. Ocean Sweet, the son of sharecroppers, the grandson of a slave. Immediately after moving into the white neighborhood in Detroit, it became clear Ocean Sweet would have to defend his family. Police were stationed around the home, but Dr. Sweet knew he would have to protect his family himself. So he gathered friends and acquaintances for protection. After supper on the evening of September 8, 1925, Ocean Sweet looked out the living room window and saw the crowd, the mob. It was terrifying, but that night passed. Kevin Boyle says the Sweets and their friends began September 9th, exhausted but unscathed. The confrontation came the following night. Two white men were shot. One was killed. The couple and their friends would be tried for murder. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest this afternoon, Kevin Boyle. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call us on our toll-free line. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Kevin Boyle was born and raised in Detroit. He is an associate professor of history at Ohio State University. His book, Arc of Justice, is published by Henry Holt. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Kevin Boyle, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be on with you.
You were born and raised in Detroit. Were you aware of this story when you were growing up?
Yeah, it's one of those stories that a lot of people in Detroit knew. At least you knew something happened, you knew the name, you knew there had been a dramatic incident. And so really the trick of writing the book was not being in Detroit anymore and realizing that outside of Detroit, it's a story that's been almost completely lost.
Yeah. Two epigraphs precede this story, and I want to share them with our listeners this afternoon. The first one is from the abolitionist Theodore Parker from the 1850s. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. That is followed then by this from Langston Hughes, 1923. That justice is a blind goddess is a thing to which we blacks are wise. Her bandage hides two festering sores that once, perhaps, were eyes. Is this a story where we bend toward justice, or in this story do we see justice with festering eyes?
That's a wonderful question. I used the first phrase, and obviously that's where the title of the book comes from as well, because there's such tremendous hope in that phrase. It's a phrase that Martin Luther King made famous, really, though Theodore Parker was the author of it. And there's such a wonderful sense of hope in that phrase. But the tragic thing about the sweet story, and the thing that I think makes it really a powerful story, one of the things that makes it a powerful story, is that it isn't, in fact, a story of justice in the end. It's a story that ties so much more closely, I think, in some ways, in some really important ways, with the Langston Hughes poem. And that's why I used that, because I wanted to balance out the optimism of that saying with the pessimism that runs so strongly through Langston Hughes' poem.
Yeah. And this is the time when, as you write in the book early in the story, there was a lot of hope and people were moving north. The cities sparkled, you wrote, but they also shimmered with hate.
Yeah, it's an incredibly important moment of transformation in American cities in the late 1910s and in the early 1920s, when there is this incredible moment of promise for millions of people, for African Americans coming out of the South looking for a better life for themselves in places like Chicago and Detroit, New York, Cleveland, and for immigrants who are coming with the end of World War II from around the world to come to the same cities in hopes of finding a better future for themselves and for their families. But as those populations increased, especially in a city like Detroit, it was also an era of the most profound forms of hatred. The Ku Klux Klan swept across urban America in the 1920s. 35,000 members in the Klan in Detroit in the early 1920s. And they were able to draw those people because they preached really some of the most vicious forms of hatred that Americans know: racism, anti-Semitism, anti-Catholicism, nativism. And they drew thousands and thousands of people to that message. So it was a time of both great promise and of really profound hatred.
Hmm. You captured so vividly the drama of these events and of this era. How were you able to find all that detail? Was it difficult?
It was great fun, to tell you the truth. I mean, I am a historian by training. It's what I do. I teach history at Ohio State. And there's nothing more fun than spending your time immersing yourself in the primary sources, and that's what I did. I think one of the things that makes the detail come through is in trying to write a book that I hope it says something to my fellow historians, but also speaks to non-academic audiences, that what you do is you read for detail. You look for kind of the telling little detail that makes a paragraph or a sentence come alive. And it's simply a way of reading the documents that's a little different than what I had done before. It's looking for just that little something that jumps out at a reader to make them feel the story as much as hear the story.
Yeah. Well, the detail begins right from the start as you give readers some sense of what it was like for people moving from the South to the North in the Great Migration. Maybe you'd give us your sense of the experience here this afternoon.
I think it kind of goes back to what we were talking about just a minute ago. There's that sense that African Americans had in the late 1910s and the early 20s as they boarded the trains leaving the rural South, or the urban South for that matter, and coming up to the cities. There was such a mix in people's minds and in people's stomachs of fear, the fear of moving, the fear of coming to a place where you didn't know anyone, a fear of coming to a place different than what you'd seen before, and the excitement of that you get in and board a train in some small town in Alabama or Mississippi, and at the end of the road, you step off that train and you're in Chicago. You know, there's such a rush of stepping into a city like Chicago, or in those days, stepping into a city like Detroit, or these days, stepping into a city like New York. And there's a wonderful quote that I put in that opening section that comes from National Geographic in the 20s, and it says about people coming into the great train stations in Grand Central Station in New York, that they step off the train, and you can always tell the country people, mm-hmm. because they stand there with the bags in their hands, and they just stare. They stare at this new world around them, and it's that glittering world. Train stations were meant to be glittering places, and when you stepped into them, you were in this kind of new world of great promise, and it must have been so exciting, and it must have been just so terrifying.
Yeah. Ocean Sweet made his way north, too. He left Central Florida at his parents' urging.
Yes.
Tell us about his background.
It's really a great American dream. Ocean Sweet came from a very humble background. His grandparents had been slaves. His parents were small-time farmers. They owned a tiny, tiny little plot of land on the black side of town in a little town in Central Florida by the name of Bartow. And he was born in Central Florida in 1895. And what that means is that he was born at the time that the Jim Crow system of the South, the system of segregation in the South, was solidified. And it was solidified in a rush of violence. And so he grew up in, came of age, in a time when white mobs could do the most horrific things four or five times when he was a child. In this tiny little town, there's nothing special about this town. It's not an extraordinary place. White men, white mobs lynched black men. The worst of those incidents, which I talk about in the book, happened when Ocean Sweet was 5 years old. He always said he saw it, though I don't think he probably didn't. A white mob took a hold of a 16-year-old black teenager and literally burned him at the stake. And when I went back to Bartow, I went down to Bartow, and I read the newspaper accounts of the local newspaper, and it's so chilling to read that because it talks about that kind of violence, that kind of cruelty, in the most casual of ways. This is what happened yesterday in town. And that's the world he grew up in. It was he came from a very tight-knit family. He came from a very devout family. They were devout members of the AME Church. And they gave to their children, Ocean was the oldest of their children, this great American desire to improve yourself, to pull yourself up as far as your talents and your ability and your hard work and your education can take you. And that became the defining force in all of the Sweet children's lives. They all had to excel. And what's more American than that?
Hmm. The woman who would become his wife, Gladys Mitchell, her childhood had been quite different.
Very different. She grew up, she was a northerner, and in that alone made things very different. She was an African-American as well. She had been born in Pittsburgh, but grew up in Detroit in the early, she was about, I think, 6, 7 years younger than him, and grew up in a very middle-class family. So whereas Dr. Sweet grew up in a relatively, well, a hard-working but hardly wealthy farm family in the Jim Crow South, she grew up in a middle-class family. Her stepfather was a musician. He played in pit orchestras in the big downtown theaters in Detroit. And she lived in a completely white neighborhood. She grew up in a completely white neighborhood on the east side of Detroit. She was the only African-American in her high school, had lived a life not of privilege, they weren't wealthy people, but of middle-class comfort and middle-class security. And whereas Dr. Sweet's rise up the ladder, up the social ladder, was a matter of scrambling, of working as hard as you could possibly do, Gladys didn't face that. They came from very different worlds. And I think part of that, I suspect, that was probably part of the attraction between them. He was marrying someone of a different background and social class than he had been. She was marrying a doctor, a medical doctor. It was a great match for both of them.
Yeah. How did he manage to accomplish all that he did between the time he left his parents in Florida and married Gladys?
Yeah, he was only 13 when he left home. They sent him away because, as I said, education was just so important to this family. And this was the Jim Crow South. There was no black high school in Bartow. His education was over had he stayed in Bartow at 13. And so they sent him away. They sent him to Wilberforce University, which is a historically black college in down near Dayton in Ohio, and it's an AME institution. So they sent him to the college of their church. And in those days, the Wilberforce had a high school academy because there were a lot of kids like Dr. Sweet, well, Ocean Sweet at those days, at that age, who had terrific talent and ability but had no place to go. And so he went and got his high school diploma from Wilberforce, and then he stayed on to get his college degree. Spent his entire time there working so he could pay the tuition, got his B.S. in chemistry in 1917 from Wilberforce, and that alone made him a higher status, more educated person virtually than most Americans, black or white. Most Americans didn't go to college in those days. And, of course, that wasn't enough for the Sweets. And so he graduated from Wilberforce in 1917 and moved on to Howard University, great black college in Washington, D.C., to medical school. He got his medical degree in 1921. So that's what I meant, really, when I was saying that he's the embodiment of the American dream. Here he goes from small-time farm family to the highest of professional standards simply by the force of education and hard work. That's America.
Yeah. On the other hand, he's got his one foot in one world and one foot in another world. You write that he remained deep down the frightened Florida farm boy. He didn't doubt his abilities. He knew he was a fine physician, better than most. But he often tried too hard to impress, to find just the right phrase, to strike just the right pose, to keep just the right distance, to reassure himself.
Yeah, in some ways I feel as if I became part of Dr. Sweet's family. I spent so much time trying to understand who he was, not simply as a figure in a story, but as a human being. And what came across again and again in the documentary evidence is exactly that, that he was a self-made man. He fits that category, that characterization perfectly. But like a lot, I think, of self-made men, there was always that sense of insecurity about him. There was always that sense that he had to prove himself, maybe not to the outside world. People, when he moved to Detroit in 1921, most people probably didn't know his background. His patients probably didn't have a clue where he came from or what his background was. They saw a fine physician. But inside, I think there was always a strong sense in Dr. Sweet that he had come from a humble background and he had to prove that he had made it in the world. And I think that was a huge part of defining his personality. There was an arrogance about him. There was an edge to him. In the same way that there was great accomplishment and great courage. He was a complicated man, I suppose, the way most human beings are.
Mm. Now, the bungalow on Garland Street that they purchased,
yeah.
This was to be another victory for them. Gladys loved it.
Yeah.
But Ocean, I have this feeling he had mixed feelings about it.
I think he did. I think both Ocean and Gladys were proud of this house. Gladys says something wonderfully revealing in one of the documents. She points out that it has one more room than her mother's house. You know, and that's, again, you know, that's what you're supposed to want. You're supposed to have the next generation do just a slightly bit better than your parents had done. And as I said, she had grown up in a white neighborhood, and so the thought of buying a house in an all-white neighborhood, which is what Garland Avenue was, didn't frighten her. It didn't seem unusual to her. It was a logical thing. They had a baby, they had a little girl, and they wanted a house in the backyard. They wanted a nice house. Dr. Sweet, I think, wanted those same things. I think he wanted, you know, the prestige that came with the house, and the house still stands. You can drive down Garland Avenue today, and it's the nicest house on the block. It was then, and it is now. And I think there was an edge of prestige to that, too.
Hmm.
But he also understood, in a way that Gladys, given her background, couldn't quite understand how dangerous this was, because he knew from that experience as a boy what a white mob could do. And he understood that if the whites in that neighborhood wanted to drive him out, they could do terrible things. And that terrified him. And that's really the dynamic that's in place. He buys the house, they put down their down payment in June of 1925, and that's the dynamic, that fear of what could happen if they move into this neighborhood and break the color line, that drives so much of the tragedy that follows after that.
Mm. How was it that Gladys was able to grow up in a white neighborhood in Detroit peacefully, and here on Garland Avenue it's another story completely?
It's a great question, and in some ways it's the pivotal question of the history that this book talks about. Prior to the early 1920s, it was commonplace for African Americans who had some money, middle class professional people, to live in white neighborhoods. It was a common thing. And so Dr. Sweet worked at a black hospital in Detroit, and most of his colleagues who were African American doctors in the hospital, they lived in white neighborhoods. It was not something that white people objected to. But it's only as the black population increases in Detroit, and it does very, very dramatically at exactly this moment, between 1910 and 1920, the black population goes from 5,700 in Detroit to 40,000. It's just this dramatic increase. And as that happens, whites start to insist that African Americans can only live in one neighborhood, and they shouldn't break out of that neighborhood to live among white people. And it's that transformation, that sudden sense that the city should have the strictest of segregations. And Detroit's not unusual. Same thing happened in Chicago and other cities. It's at that moment of transformation that Dr. Sweet buys the house on Garland. And it's that, because it's at that moment that the tragedy unfolds. From Mrs. Sweet's perspective, this is the most logical thing in the world.
Yeah. Well, moving north along with African Americans, the Klan and Jim Crow.
Exactly. Jim Crow follows a really different path. Detroit and the other great cities never impose the rule of law that says there has to be separate drinking fountains or separate waiting rooms or separate seats in the theaters. It's all done kind of on a ad hoc basis. But where the critical segregation of the cities comes in is in that neighborhood segregation. And it's not simply that whites all of a sudden say, well, I don't want a black neighbor, though they do. That spreads very rapidly across cities. But it's also that the forces of the real estate marketplace all of a sudden enforce segregation. And so realtors decide, and they say it explicitly when they put it in their bylaws of the Realtors Association, that realtors won't show African Americans homes in white neighborhoods. That would be a violation of ethics. Banks say that if an African American wants to move into a white neighborhood, they won't give them a mortgage. Insurance companies won't insure their home. And with those forces in place, then all of a sudden segregation goes, the resentment of blacks moving into a neighborhood goes from racism into the strictest of segregations. And it really happens in Detroit very, very rapidly. It happens really in a 5, 6, 7 year period.
Yeah. Well, this was also a time of lynching and police brutality, riots, race riots across the country. Springfield, Illinois, 1908.
Yeah, it's one of the things that surprised me writing this book. I didn't imagine when I set out to write this book that so much of it would become one of the great backdrops of the story is this history of racial violence that we know of the lynchings in the South. That's something that's passed into our popular memory. What we've lost is the series of race riots that happened in cities, Springfield, Illinois being one of the great symbolic race riots, African Americans attacked by mobs of whites in the very town where Abraham Lincoln is buried. But there are others as well. Chicago has a brutal race riot in 1919. Washington, D.C. has a brutal race riot in 1919. Ocean Sweet's in Washington, D.C. in 1919 because he's in medical school in Howard in 1919. And there's days of anti-black rioting in Washington, D.C. in 1919, driven in part by the Washington Post, which basically tells the white mobs to get out into the street to attack blacks. And it's rampant violence across, racial violence across America in the early years of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And that's the world Dr. Sweet knows.
Yeah. Springfield, also East St. Louis, Chicago.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, cities, Houston, city after city, but it's northern as well as southern.
Yeah. Sumner, Florida.
Yes.
Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Oh, Tulsa, of course, is one of the worst examples. I mean, the entire black section of town essentially burned to the ground. And those are big stories. Dr. Sweet read the newspapers. Dr. Sweet read the black newspapers. He knew all about these events. He knew all about how violent the world was around him, toward him. And again, that's what feeds so much into the fear he feels in daring himself to cross the color line, because he knows that it's a very, very dangerous thing to do. And he's right.
Yeah. He also doesn't want to be a coward.
Yeah. And that's part of the pride. That what happens in part is he and Mrs. Sweet Gladys put down the down payment in June. And then almost immediately, there are a series of 4 different incidents in Detroit, on the other side of town, on the far side of town. And Detroit's a big sprawling city. But on the other side of town, there's 4 separate incidents that summer of whites driving African Americans out of their new homes in white neighborhoods. Two of those incidents happened to people Dr. Sweet knows. He's friends. One of them is one of his fellow physicians. And when those families, especially that fellow physician, when they give up, when they are driven out by the mob and say, the heck with it, you can have my house, which is what this other physician had done, the black community sees that other physician as such a coward. Why didn't he stand up to the mob? And Dr. Sweet knows that. He's part of that conversation. And he can't quite imagine himself being that much of a coward. So while he's terrified, and quite frankly, and I want to make this really clear, for heck, if it were me, they could have the house. I mean, I'm the biggest coward you ever saw. So it's perfectly understandable why anyone would back off in the face of a mob. But Dr. Sweet didn't want to have that blow to his pride. He wanted to do the right thing, and it drove him forward, even though he was so scared about moving into that neighborhood on Garland Avenue.
Yeah. Now, in his old neighborhood, I believe called Black Bottom in Detroit, there were periods of police repression. There were also efforts and actions on the part of that neighborhood's residents to protest the affronts they suffered. What kinds of challenges to white supremacy were mounted, and how successful or unsuccessful were they?
Well, there were all sorts of different strands of black politics in Detroit in the 1920s, as there were in so many other cities. The NAACP had been very active in Detroit in the 1910s. It fell on hard times, the Detroit branch, in the early 20s. Dr. Sweet didn't belong to it, as far as I never found any evidence that he did. He wasn't himself a civil rights activist. There were attempts at what was called racial uplift, that the best men in the black community would try to raise the standards of the poorest African Americans. Dr. Sweet was involved in that. You know, he would go to various black churches for what the doctors mounted as hygiene day to teach people how to, proper hygiene methods. There was black nationalism in Detroit. There was a Garveyite movement in Detroit, but the Sweets certainly weren't part of that. It was much more a working class movement, and the Sweets weren't a working class family. There were lots of different strands, but there was no, in Detroit at that point, there was no kind of organized civil rights movement, no center to all that activity. It was kind of sporadic protest. And there were all sorts of problems the black community had. They didn't get city services equally. The police were incredibly repressive. The police were a center of Klan activity in Detroit, and they were brutal in the black neighborhood in Detroit. That was why Dr. Sweet didn't trust the police to protect him. When he moved into his house, he asked for police protection, but he didn't think they would come through for him. But there was no kind of center organizing principle, and Dr. Sweet, as I said, certainly wasn't involved in virtually any of those activities. He was a man intent on building his medical practice. He was still in his 20s and building a young family and moving up the ladder. He wasn't a political activist.
He did, however, and I hope you'll tell this story now, he did, however, take part in an action meant to make a statement about Ty Cobb.
Yeah, he did. That was actually a great story. Ty Cobb was the great star of the Detroit Tigers, and in some ways, clearly one of the greatest baseball players of all time. Ty Cobb was also just the most vicious of racists. He had grown up in rural Georgia, and he had Jim Crow pouring through his veins, and he was given to violent outbursts. I mean, he would just beat a black man several times. He beat black men on the streets or in hotels who he thought had insulted him. And often nothing had happened. Someone looked at him sideways and he'd start wailing away at some poor innocent person. And one day, one evening, Detroit announced it was going to have this big award ceremony for Ty Cobb, to honor Ty Cobb. And they were going to have a big fancy dinner, and people were invited to buy seats at the dinner. And one of Dr. Sweet's colleagues, African-American doctor at this hospital, decided he was going to go to this event. He was going to buy a table, and he was going to invite some friends, and they were going to come to this event, which, of course, was just a way of rubbing Ty Cobb's nose in it, that here was the city honoring him, big fancy dinner, and in are going to walk eight or whatever the number, distinguished black men to take their seats at the table. And he invited Ocean to come to the dinner with him, and Ocean came to the dinner with him. And Ty Cobb luckily didn't leap off the head table and come over to hit anybody in the audience that night. But it was just a classic kind of snub just to see if you could get away with it. But that was the level of Dr. Sweet's activism. You know, it's a fun thing to do. And, you know, of course, it's a gutsy thing to do, but it's not going to change the Jim Crow system any. And it was a symbol both that he wanted, I think, to be involved in civil rights activism, but it was all very low-level stuff until that day he moved into a new home.
Yeah. Historian Kevin Boyle is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He's an associate professor of history at Ohio State University. His latest book is Arc of Justice, a saga of race, civil rights, and murder in the Jazz Age. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions. 333-9455, the number to dial if you'd like to join the discussion and you're in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, use the toll-free line 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Well, let's go back to that riot in Springfield, Illinois, 1908. The city was rent by that violence, and it led to the founding of the NAACP.
Yeah, the violence, which had lasted several days in Springfield, was, as I said a little while ago, such a symbolic thing. I mean, of all the places in America, Springfield, Illinois, with its deep roots and deep connections to Abraham Lincoln, and to have a race riot in that city, it led a group of civil rights liberals, white people and black people, to decide that they needed to form some sort of civil rights organization that could try to stem this tide of racial violence and racial division in the United States, North and South. And it's from that terrible moment that the NAACP is born. It's dominated in its early days by whites, mostly the sons and daughters, or grandsons and granddaughters, of the abolitionist generation. There are, of course, African Americans involved. W.E.B. Du Bois is the greatest example. But it tends, in the early days, to be dominated by white liberals. Gradually, in the course of the early 20th century, African Americans took control of the organization. And by the time of the Sweet case, it was an African American controlled organization led by really one of the great Renaissance men of the 20th century America, James Weldon Johnson.
How does the NAACP figure in the story of Ocean and Gladys Sweet?
They're really pivotal, because what happens, as you said at the top of the show, what happens is that the mob does come. September 9th, 1925, mob gathers on the street, the African-Americans, and there's 11 of them in the house, Dr. and Mrs. Sweet, his two of his brothers, and a group of friends. They're in the house, and they're up in the upstairs windows with guns, waiting to protect the house in case that mob should attack. 100, 200 whites gather outside the house on September 9th, and they start throwing stones at the house about 8:30 in the evening. And when that happens, African-Americans open fire on the mob, and they kill a white man. The man lived down the block from the Sweets, and he had come down to watch what was going to happen at the Sweets' house and to be in, you know, part of the excitement of the evening. And when that happens, then the African-Americans, the 11 people, Dr. and Mrs. Sweet and his brothers and friends, they're all arrested and charged with first-degree murder, all 11 of them. And within 2 days of their arrest, news of that arrest spreads to New York City, which is where the NAACP was then headquartered. Just a tiny little story comes in back pages in the newspaper. The head of the NAACP, James Weldon Johnson, sees that story. And for a variety of reasons tied with what the NAACP itself was trying to do in those days, it says, we will come to defend the Sweets. We will mount the defense for the Sweets. And so this becomes a great cause célèbre for the NAACP in its attempt to confront the growing segregation of American cities.
Hmm. We have a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's go and take this call. Next, listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I think your guest has brought to at least our public, and I hope it goes a long way, a story of absolute tragedy that happened only 80 years ago. And here we are now, preaching democracy around the world, and everybody here is saying, well, why are the Sunnis and the Shiites killing each other? And here we were 80 years ago with 35,000 Ku Klux Klan persons in Detroit alone doing exactly the same job over here, you know? I think we need to learn a little more from history before we go out there and start being the wild cowboy in the Middle East.
I think it's a fascinating parallel. I have to admit that I have never thought of it. But I agree completely that what we have to do in this country is we have to confront our racial past and, quite frankly, our racial present, that we can't assume that these divisions have somehow disappeared, because the sad fact is that they haven't.
Even today, Ty Cobb is regarded as a hero, and he was one of the most disgusting men to ever walk the earth.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. You know, no one's arguing he shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. I mean, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Well, maybe we should start a campaign to get him booted out.
But if I do that, unfortunately, I'll never be able to go back home to Detroit.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Enjoy the program.
Thank you for calling.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, back now to the events that unfold following the shooting. How did the police handle the incident and the investigation, and how did the prosecutors approach the case?
The police are on the street at the moment of the shooting. There are about a dozen policemen on the street. And the minute the shooting happens, the policemen race into the house and arrest all the African-Americans. They've done nothing to stop the throwing of stones, but they arrested all the African-Americans the minute the shooting started. And then really from that moment on, this becomes a huge story in Detroit, understandably, and the newspapers the next morning have the Sweets and their friends convicted. They've decided they're guilty, this is murder, and what the prosecutor does is, under this kind of intense political pressure, he brings murder charges against, first-degree murder charges against them. Even much of the legal community was so surprised by that, because at worst, this seemed like a case of manslaughter, but he argues for all 11 people, there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever that Mrs. Sweet ever fired a gun. She was in the kitchen trying to make dinner for these 10 people and the 10 other people in her house. And she is charged with first-degree murder. And the assumption right off the bat across Detroit, except in the black community, is that these people are going to be convicted. Detroit didn't have Michigan didn't have the death penalty then. So they were facing life imprisonment, and the sentiment in Detroit was so strongly against them, except in the black community, that it looked like a hopeless situation.
Mm. So enter the NAACP and Clarence Darrow.
Exactly. The NAACP says, well, we'll mount the defense. It takes them about a month to put a defense together because they have trouble finding a lawyer who's willing to take this case. But when they do find a lawyer, they find one very, very good lawyer. They hire Clarence Darrow as the defense attorney for the Sweets. Darrow is then at the height of his fame. The summer of 1925 had been the famous Scopes trial in Dayton, Tennessee. And this is Clarence Darrow's next case. He comes to Detroit to defend the Sweets in November of 1925.
Hmm. And what kind of defense did he mount?
Well, it's a classic Clarence Darrow defense. Clarence Darrow was not a expert in the law. He didn't know the law very well. He didn't care about the law very well. He didn't even respect the law at all. What he cared about were issues and words. And what he does is a series of things in this defense. And they're fascinating things. Partly what he does is he transforms the trial he has an all-white jury, completely white male jury. He transforms the trial from a trial of Dr. Sweet to a trial of the white people of Garland Avenue, those people in the mob. And what he does is he transforms them into models, into exemplars of the intolerance sweeping across Detroit. Over and over again, he refers to them, to the jury, as the noble Nordics of Garland Avenue, which is a code word in 1920s to say they're Klansmen. Well, they weren't. This wasn't a Klan neighborhood. But he transforms them into Klansmen, and he puts them on trial. And then what he does is he puts Dr. Sweet on the stand, which obviously he does not have to do. I mean, no one who's a defendant has to testify. But he goes for this huge gamble, and he puts Dr. Sweet on the stand. And Dr. Sweet, of course, is an educated man. He's a very poised man. He handles himself very well on the stand. And what Darrow then does is he says, okay, you make the comparison. Here you have these white people claiming that they're superior by the color of their skin, but look at them. Look at these people. Do you think they're better somehow than Dr. Sweet? And then he does what is also a classic Darrow thing. He loves to do this in trials. At the end, he makes these long, elaborate, beautiful closing statements. His closing statement in the Sweet trial is 7 hours long. And it's just this cascade of words and images. And he talks about the history of the race, of the African-American race. And he talks about injustice and intolerance. And he humiliates the witnesses from Garland Avenue and makes fun of them and calls them names. And then at the end, after 7 hours, he turns to the jurors, and what he says is, go ahead, convict them. You can do that. But you know in your heart, if you do that, you will never be able to live with yourself. He just throws down the gauntlet, and he says, because if you convict them, you're going to do it because of intolerance and nothing else. And it's this dare to the jurors, go ahead, try it. But you know that if you do it, you're wrong. And it's just incredibly powerful.
In the end, I don't know how much you want to reveal, although I would say if you revealed the whole thing, this book is so worth reading. It is just exquisite.
Well, thank you. That's very nice of you.
But what happened in the end to the Sweets?
There are, in fact, two trials. The first trial of all 11 defendants ends in a hung jury. The jurors can't decide whether to convict or not. They're out for 48 hours. It's over Thanksgiving weekend. And then they do it again. They put one of the 11 African-Americans on trial. They pick Dr. Sweet's little brother, Henry. And the reason they do that is the night of the arrest, the night of the murder, he's the only one who says to the police, well, of course I fired into the crowd. Everyone else, all the other defendants say, there was shooting, but it wasn't me. Henry says, of course I fired into the crowd. They were going to kill us. And so if they can't convict Henry, they can't convict anybody. And the case goes back to trial in April and May of 1926. Darrow comes back to defend Henry Sweet, and in the end, the jury is out less than an afternoon, and they acquit Henry Sweet. So in one sense, it's a great triumph. This is just a huge triumph for the NAACP. They have convinced a all-white jury that a black man had the right to defend himself from mob attack, even if it meant killing somebody, a white man. That's amazing. On the other hand, and this kind of comes back to your caller's, the caller's comment from a little while ago, on the other hand, the underlying principle of this case was to confront the issue of racial segregation in the cities. That system of segregation, 80 years later, is still in place. And of all of American cities, the most segregated is Ocean Suites, Detroit. And so in a very real sense, while the case is a triumph, the underlying principle is a tremendous tragedy, that we still live in a society in urban America where African Americans and whites live in worlds that are separate and unequal.
So for a time, a bright light was shown on the situation, but then, as in so many situations, so many stories of great import, that bright light moves on to another story.
That's right. It flickers out. And that's why, really, at the very start of the book, I have both those quotes. Because there is that moment of hope, and then there is that bitterness, too, of a story that doesn't end the way you want it to end.
Yeah. Well, in the beginning pages of the book, when you're writing about how the cities came to be segregated, it's so striking that that no one, you write, no one coordinated the businessmen's practices and the homeowners' actions. They spread by quiet agreement, sealed by a handshake in the boardroom, a directive from the home office, a conversation over coffee in the neighbor's kitchen. Maybe it's not even quite, it's even more subtle today, but it's that.
Exactly.
Sums it up, doesn't it?
Exactly. I think you're exactly right. And that's one of the... And it's so interesting that here we are talking politics in America over and over again. Presidential election just ended, and neither candidate ever that I know of addressed this issue. No one said, this is wrong, and we have to make it better.
Yeah. One quick question here, and we've got to wrap it up because we're moving beyond the time that we can spend together today. How has the book been received in Detroit?
Very well, actually. Detroit has really embraced this book, which is wonderful. In fact, I was up in Detroit yesterday giving a talk at a local college, and the response has just been terrific. There's a lot of interest in it. People feel as if they're discovering more about their own history, both in the black and white communities in Detroit, which is still, as I said, very racially divided. And it's been really, really wonderful for me, because, as I said, too, it's my hometown, to feel that people are finding something worthwhile in the book in Detroit.
Mm. Kevin, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Historian Kevin Boyle has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of Arc of Justice, A Saga of Race, Civil Rights, and Murder in the Jazz Age. The book is winner of the National Book Award. It's published by Henry Holt. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. We begin with outside markets, where the CRB is at 313.91, up 1.26, while the U.S. dollar is down 42 at 81.55. That provided an uptick on the market today, ahead of tomorrow's USDA World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimate reports, as well as ending stock carryouts for wheat, corn, and soybeans. Those reports due out tomorrow morning at 7:30 Central Time by 7:45. If you go to our website at WILL.UIUC.EDU, click on AM on the left-hand side of the page, agriculture on the right, we'll have those numbers posted for you. Let's go ahead and look at the tick today. March wheat, a high on the day at 334, a low of 328 and three quarters, settling 333 and a half, up 4.5. May, a high of 342, a low of 336, settling 340 and three quarters, up 3.5. July, a high of 348 and a half, a low of 342 and a quarter, settling 347 and a half, up 3.75. September, a high of 353 and a half, a low of 348, settling 353, up 3.25. In December, a high of 362, a low of 356, settling 361, up 4.5 on the day. March corn, a high of 209 and a half, a low of 206 and a quarter, settling 209 and a quarter, up 2.5. May, a high of 216 and a half, a low of 213 and a quarter, settling 216 and a quarter, up 2. July, a high of 223 and a half, a low of 220 and a quarter, settling 223 and a quarter, up 2. September, a high of 230 and a half, a low of 226 and a half, settling 230, up 2.75. December, a high of 239 and a half, a low of 234 and a half, settling 238 and a half, up 3.25. And March, a high of 245, a low of 241, settling 244 and 3/4, up 3.25 on the day. March oats, a high of 175 and a half, a low of 175 and a quarter, settling 175 and a half, unchanged. May, a high of 155, a low of 153 and a quarter, settling 154 and 3/4, up 1. March beans, a high of 625, a low of 615 and a half, settling 624, up 4.5. May, a high of 632, a low of 622, settling 629 and a half, up 4. July, a high of 635, a low of 626, settling 634, up 4.75. August, a high of 634, a low of 625 and a half, settling 631 and a half, up 5.25. September, a high of 622, a low of 616, settling 621, up 4.5. November, a high of 617 and a half, a low of 609 and a half, settling 615 and a half, up 3. March soybean meal, a high of 182.20, a low of 179.20, settling 181.70, up 50. May, a high of 186, a low of 183, settling 185, 40 up 70. March soybean oil, a high of 23.67, a low of 23.35, settling 23.60 up 18. May, a high of 23.86, a low of 23.40, settling 23.64 up 21. Be sure to tune in at 2:06 Central Time for our closing market report, when Paul Cooley of ABM Investment Services will give his take on market action today. Prices are also in over on the Mercantile Exchange, where it's been a higher day in the feeder cattle and live cattle pit, Celeste.
That's right. It looks like the feeders and the live cattle finished higher, while lean hogs and bellies took a tumble today. March feeder cattle, today's high 106.40, the low 103.95, the settlement 105.87 and a half, that up 195. April 106.50, the high 103.55, the low 105.67 and a half, the settlement, that up 212 and a half. May 105.40, the high 102.50, the low 104.75, the settlement, that up 232 and a half. April live cattle 92.25, the high 89.52 and a half, the low, the settlement 91.45, that up 220. June live cattle 87.70, the high 85.10, the low, the settlement 87.50, that up 230. April lean hog 76 even, the high 74.15, the low 74.57 and a half, the settlement, that down 152 and a half. May 78.50, the high 76.70, the low, finishing at 77.55, down 115. June lean hogs 81.45, the high 79.75, the low 80.65, the settlement, that down 107 and a half. July lean hog 78.50, the high, the low 76.80, the settlement 77.62 and a half, that down 110. And March pork bellies 88.90, the high, the low 86.05, the settlement 86.30, that down 275. The Dow is off 69 points at 10,843, the S&P 500 down 7 at 1212.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Bob Maluga from Portland, Maine writes, "Dear Dr. Science, which Baptist church really is the First Baptist?"
That would be the Roman Catholic Church. You see, the First Baptist, John the Baptist, was a Roman Catholic. He was actually an O'Malley, and his mother, Anne, was an O'Shaughnessy. Of course, they don't teach you that in school anymore. Heck, you can't even pray in the locker room during halftime, much less discuss the pedigree of the locust-eating prophet who ended up losing his